It's Wednesday at 2:06 in the afternoon, and we are coming to you from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Midtown Atlanta. My partner, Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is with me, and so is our first citizen panel since Donald Trump became president of the United States. We have seven people, and they're all with us today for Political Rewind. Although, Johannes Kleiner, you tell us you're the one non-citizen, you're a green card holder.
That's right. Originally from Germany, moved to the U.S. In 2011 on a student visa, had been there a year before, and then moved to Georgia in 2012 to be at Emory, and have been a green card holder since 2015.
All right. Why don't we go around and have you each say hello, tell us who you are. And while we do that, tell us who you voted for in November. Colton?
Okay, well, my name is Colton Sagabell. I'm 24 years old, originally from Peachtree City, Georgia, but I'm a senior at Auburn University. It's my last semester. And I voted for Donald Trump this time around.
LaDan?
LaDan Pratt. I live in Johns Creek, Georgia. I voted for Donald Trump.
Brett Walker. I live in Macon, Georgia. And I also voted for Donald Trump.
Karen Fierro Verde, I live in Marietta, Georgia, and I was with her this time around.
Hillary Clinton.
Tia Buckham White from Atlanta, Georgia, and I voted for Hillary Clinton.
Scott Auerbach, I live in East Atlanta, the best neighborhood in town, and I voted for Hillary Clinton.
Okay, so thank you for introducing yourselves. Jim, it strikes me that a good starting point for this conversation might be to ask our Trump voters how they feel about the way their candidate has performed since taking office. What do you think?
Okay, what is it, a 40-day test?
Yeah, about a
47-day
test. But who's counting, LaDan? Yeah.
Finance.
Well, LaDan, you have the microphone. How's he done so far? Has he lived up to your expectations?
I think he's done great. He could be a little bit more descriptive and more explaining more what is he trying to do. I think he's very high level, like with immigration ban when he came out with, he didn't explain the details and a lot of people assumed the worst and everybody called it a ban. It's not a ban, it's a pause. And that's why we had so much chaos for just a few days. But I think he's done great.
I'll just go ahead and say as a caveat, I was a very reluctant Donald Trump voter. I've voted in presidential elections. The last Republican I voted for was Ronald Reagan. So it was tough for me. It was really tough. And how has he done? I've gotten to where I don't really pay attention to the man so much. Because really, he's going to say a lot of crazy things. But I think policy-wise, I like the direction. I really do. I think that there's some positive direction here and can't really assess whether it's getting us where we need to go or not. But I think the direction's good.
Colton, a lot of people have said whether in because they're happy about it or because they're befuddled by it, he is doing exactly what people elected him to do. Is that correct?
I would say for the most part. I mean, we've still yet to see certain things. Like, obviously, this stuff has to go through Congress. You know, like, we just saw yesterday the release of the new Obamacare. The repeal and replace of Obamacare, the start of that, at least. We still have tax reform to go, see if he'll actually, you know, keep up with the infrastructure bill, which I hope that happens. But I say for the most part, he is doing what he said he would do. I mean, I honestly didn't think he was really going to try to build a wall, though. Like, I thought that was more metaphor than actual, he's going to actually build a wall, like, when I voted for him.
Are you happy with his interaction with Congress so far? I think that's the one new thing I think we've seen this week with the launching of Obamacare. We finally have some real kind of integration with Republican Congress.
Well, for me, definitely the speech he gave the other day, I thought it was phenomenal. I thought he did much better.
Speech in front of the joint
session. In front of the joint session of Congress, excuse me. But I think, you know, let's see what he does here. Let's see if he can really be a deal maker, because, you know, there's going to be a lot of the more conservative Republicans that are going to be against this bill. And then, you know, you're going to have a lot more of the Democrats against this bill. Well, so we'll see if he can actually mediate and try to make a deal here.
I think we need to sample the people who were with her. Scott, what's your...
He's living down to my expectations. I do have to say that the joint address to Congress was far more quote unquote presidential than he had been to date. Although it's hard for me to imagine being less presidential than he had been up until that point. The jury's out in terms of what he actually wants to do. It seems to me that during the campaign, so much of what he said were kind of slogans and mottos and not policy. And that's, of course, how Washington works, is policy.
Policy.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
Tia, when you're the one member of this panel who did our voter panel, one of our voter panels, and you were a fierce Hillary Clinton supporter, and you were very firm in feeling that Donald Trump had no place in the White House. How are you feeling these days?
Well, yes, I was fierce, but you also were calling me out for my neutrality around Hillary Clinton, so I wasn't totally...
I apologize. That's exactly right.
I wasn't totally swinging from the fences, not because I did not think that
Hillary... Thank you for correcting me.
No worries. I think that, you know, I don't think that Hillary Clinton was able to get us off our couches, is what I like to say. I think that, you know, when she had the opportunity, although I think she's the most qualified person on paper to run the country, I think that piece that she claimed in one of her debates, she's not a Bill Clinton, she's not a Barack Obama, she's not going to speak the soaring language, you know, that thing mm-hmm. she said, I think that kind of hurt her a little bit, because I think mm-hmm. what Trump did was got people off their couches.
So how about Trump right now?
He is also living up to my expectations. I think that he's doing everything that I probably thought he would do, which is why I didn't vote for him. I think he also, his cabinet looks the way I expected it to look. You know, from a class standpoint, they're worth the amount of money I thought they'd probably all be worth. They're saying the things that I expect them to say, and they're defending themselves in a way that I expect them to defend themselves. So I definitely think that he is meeting the standard of why he did not earn my vote. And it's concerning. It's a little concerning.
Karen?
You know, I will say that I had, after I grieved, I didn't have the expectation that the Democrats would mobilize in the way that they have in the resistance movement. And to that point, I am grateful to Donald Trump for that. However, as far as what he's done while he's in office, he still continues to tap dance around the issues. And so does his Congress does follow. Today in the press conference that Tom Price was at, rolling out the new plan, which is 19,937 pages smaller than the original plan for healthcare. You know, there were poignant questions posted, and one of which is, what are the numbers? We don't have the numbers. And that seems to be a continual issue that was happening during the campaign and now in the presidency.
Johannes, I know we don't want to put you on the spot for speaking on behalf of the whole continent, but you're kind of in that position. What's the view from Europe?
Well, I just, as I said before we started the show, I just came back from Germany on Saturday, and my experience was that from my 10-year-old godchild up to my 84-year-old grandmother, everyone was talking about Trump. So
isn't that
presidential,
great?
Presidential politics are very, very present. And I was actually somewhat surprised how informed people were. I would say U.S. politics is on the news as much as it is on local channels here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And my godchild, they even had a little mock election. This is in grade school, right? So they They are engaged. People in Germany certainly have their eyes on the U.S., and they are following the situation very closely.
And how are they feeling about President Trump?
I think they are most of all befuddled and unsure how a country that so many Germans look up to, starting from the liberation in the Second World War up until the era and the days of communism, and they see it as something that does not make sense, that there is has been a campaign that was so intense and divisive and that was so just void of substance.
Okay.
is the opinion that I encountered.
What's the best thing Donald Trump has done since becoming president of the United States? And what's the worst thing you think he's done since becoming president?
I would like to say that I think what Karen said about, this is Tia speaking.
Thank you, Tia.
I'm going to get it down. But no, what Karen said about, I think that he's done the job of mobilizing people who did not want him to be the president. I think that never again will they allow that to be the case, where they don't vote and they don't stand up for rights and they don't consider their platform. I think I've heard that on a level that I've never heard before with friends who I didn't even know were progressive.
So in other words, he's energized the opposition.
Absolutely, in a way that I've never seen before in terms of my experience. Voting.
Sure. I mean, if you look at the Women's March, as far as I recall, that's the largest single march gathering that we've had in this country. So, I'd have to agree that if nothing else, and regardless of whether it's, you know, mobilizing the progressives or not, if nothing else, I think it has caused people to pay attention to the right and the responsibility and the duty of voting.
I'll say that what I think he's done more than anything in his unorthodox way. I mean, it's totally, you know, nobody can explain it, but it's effective. Whatever he does, it seems to work. But I think what he's really done is he's got us starting to have some discussions that we need to have in this country.
About what?
About immigration, number one, and that's the big one. And what I've seen, you know, I told you, this is Brent, by the way, I said that I was a liberal for many years, and I've seen my party really lose its values. What I thought was liberalism, freedom of speech, you know, it's a big part of what I really valued. And now I see so many people on that side that want to label. They want to name call. They want to shut down opposition rather than having a free flow of ideas, so that we can discuss and we can find out and get to the bottom of this. You know, it's not all or nothing. It's not either you're for open borders or you're an Islamophobe. There's a middle ground there. And I really feel like if nothing else, he's maybe started to crack that and get us talking about it.
I feel like the best thing that I've noticed him do, and this is purely from comic standpoint,
this is Karen.
This is Karen. Thanks. Was that press conference that he did that was, you know, hours long and kind of this tirade. It's like, here's the guy. Here's our president. This is it. This is him, carte blanche. And I would say the worst thing that he's done is continually, I don't care if a president tweets, but at least be grammatically correct.
I mean, is that really the biggest bone you're going to pick this week?
You know what? For now, he has not rolled out anything that of substance. These immigration executive orders are, you know, BS, really. I mean, I'm just, it's, come on. I have friends who work with refugees. The vetting process is ridiculous for these people. They have.
You mean it's already tough?
It's
is what you're saying?
Okay, this I just want to make clear. This is a years-long, 18-month-plus process
for people who are seeking safety and are seeking opportunity, and they want that for their children. The same thing we want for our kids, people in other countries want for their kids. Yeah. And the fact that they're saying now we have to do extreme vetting, this isn't a McDonald's value meal. This isn't supersize me. This is real people who want to affect change in their own lives.
You know, Jim, well, I think we should go to LaDan. Sure, because, LaDan, you were born in one of the countries, Iran, that President Trump has excluded from immigration for the time being.
Yes. I'm a Muslim, and I was born in Iran, Tehran.
Were you a refugee?
No, I wasn't, but I also don't think U.S. is a shelter for the rest of the world. If those people need help, I think other countries need to get together and help them where they live. The bringing them to our country is not the answer. We have to help them where they live, where their home is. The humanitarian efforts and all that love and care, and we love them, we need to help them. You know what? Help them in their land.
But
in
may
their
I ask,
city.
Was Iran at war when you came to the United States?
The Iran was at war, yes. Okay. I've been there. I have lived in the basement with duct tape on the walls. I worked very, very hard to get where I am now. But again, the refugees and immigrants tend to be the most aggressive, the most intelligent, the most able, the richest, the most intelligent people of every country. That's why they leave the country, because they want the best for themselves and their family. By depleting the country of their talent, if we just send them back to their country, then they will be a change agent for that country. Iran would be a lot better country right now if all the millionaires and intelligent, every Iranian I know is either a brain surgeon or heart doctor or a lawyer and a millionaire and a billionaire, and they own 90% of Los Angeles.
And they're all gone. Let me put a question.
If you complain, go back.
I'm going to interrupt you because we need to take a break. When we come back, though, I do want to continue the conversation in general about immigration. It's one of the most important questions we probably can talk about tonight, and I want to get everybody in the mix here. But let's get a break out of the way. This is our special citizens panel of Political Rewind. It is really a pleasure to have all these folks in the room with us today, and we will continue right after a very quick break.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal. Resolved to lose a few pounds this year? How about a few thousand? Donate your old car, truck, or RV. Drop a lot of unwanted weight from your garage and support public radio.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR and thanks.
Break it down.
Politics, strange bedfellows. You've heard about that, right?
We have the skills and we know the community. Invest in us and then we can build a community from the bottom up.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Nonprofits getting together to fight for funding and trust. We'll have that story the rest of the day's business news and the numbers from Wall Street as well. All next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6 on your GPB station.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm here with AJC political writer and my colleague Jim Galloway. You read him on Thursdays and Sundays in the Constitution, and he oversees the Political Insider blog every day of the week, 24/7. We're talking, Jim, as you know, to a group of people who contacted us to say they really had a lot on their minds about what's happening in Washington and Georgia, and it's really great to have everybody together.
Yeah.
I want to continue this conversation about immigration because it really is one of the most important things we can talk about. So let me go to the Clinton side of the room for a minute. Yeah, are any of let me say it a different way. I guess the people who don't like Trump, whether you were a big Clinton supporter or not.
Yeah, certainly more accurate to describe me that way.
Okay, fine. Which of you think that what Donald Trump has done in excluding now six countries from immigration is an anti-Muslim policy.
This is Scott. I think that that certainly is a large factor in it. Yes, these are also states that are failed states and states that have a significant terrorism problem. But as has been pointed out earlier, our vetting process right now for immigrants and for refugees is already incredibly rigorous. And if you talk to the people in the State Department who handle that, they will say that we cannot imagine what else we could do. Not to mention the fact that refugees, of course, don't get to pick which country they're sent to. And if you look worldwide at the refugee issue, we're taking a tiny fraction of what many of the countries in Europe are taking, even though they're far smaller than us.
So I ask that question in part because LaDan is Muslim, and she thinks that this new policy that was rolled out this week is absolutely correct. Are anybody surprised by that?
Yeah. Well, I am I am curious for the people who are against this pause on immigration for the purpose of doing more vetting and more study to see what are we supposed to do. Why? Why are you against it? Do you have a dog in the fight? Do you have a cousin and brother and sister and someone out there stuck that you're trying to get them?
Okay.
I'm trying to figure
who
out.
Who wants to answer that?
I would be happy to jump in because there are people who are sailing in the ocean picking up the bodies of two-year-olds.
But how is it personally relates to you? You care because you have a kind heart.
I care because these are people who need help. Okay. And because, oh, well done, LaDan. I care because these are people who need help. And they have looked for help. And none has been offered to them. So they are doing the most desperate thing possible to help their family and at the cost of death. And to me, that is heartening. It deserves our attention.
It is.
I don't think that it's a Muslim ban, but I think it's interesting that the Muslim countries are targeted.
Let's get some other people who we haven't heard from for a while.
Yeah, so this is Johannes. And what is striking to me is that, as many of you have already said, it is an incredibly rigorous process. And the people who look up to the U.S. for shelter, who look to the Statue of Liberty and have this mentality, we can come to this country and find shelter. I empathize with those people because it is really a refuge. And what the travel ban does, I don't think actually it is necessary. As we have heard, there doesn't seem to be an imminent threat. There is already vetting in place. So in my mind, it's exclusively playing to the base because you could simply say we'll adjust on the fly or something. There doesn't need to be a ban.
Brent, you were one of those. You're one of those people who's been kind of on the fence. I mean, you're a Democrat, but you ended up voting for Trump. So I'm especially interested in your thoughts on this. Is he doing the right thing in your mind on this?
I think so. I really, you know, I can understand Karen's compassion. But the facts are we're only taking 50,000 refugees a year. Under Obama, it was 110,000. We could take 1 million and it would still be a drop in the bucket on the poverty,
yes,
the sorrow, the horrible situation in the world. So I understand where they're coming from. We're still picking winners and losers, and there's still going to be some of this happen out in the world. And I feel like people that talk about the vetting process, I don't know where you're getting your information from. I don't know how it's being done, honestly. And I really feel like there's gotta be something more. I mean.
Let's get Tia, get you in here, and then Jim Galloway has a new issue he wants to take on.
Well, I've been trying to take it all in, and I do have a unique perspective. I'm a Southerner from the state of Mississippi, and I'm actually from a recruited group of people because I'm an African-American, so we kind of were brought here against our will.
Yeah, what do you think of Ben Carson saying yesterday that slaves were involuntary immigrants?
Well, if you think about, I don't get the piece about immigration in terms of that correlation to us, but I will tell you we were involuntarily brought here.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was in Africa in September. And just to go back to Johannes real quickly, I mean, when people would hear our group speaking and hear the American accent, Germans, Australians, people from, you know, South Africans, black South Africans would come and, you know, say, oh, we feel so bad for you, right? White South Africans definitely seemed to generally a little bit more for Trump, which is interesting to me. So just to give a context of that, you know, the international
I took you
piece,
off track on immigration.
Yeah, but I will say that I feel that there's a lack of understanding, a willingness to have a discussion about the real numbers and what's really happening and what immigrants that come to our country are doing. I think we're buying into some of the rhetoric around the you know, the murder rate and who's breaking the law. And statistically, it seems like every time that comes up, no one really wants to have a real conversation and look at the actual numbers to show we're not bringing in as many as some of these smaller countries. And it gets kind of exploded into this other conversation that we can't have a real discussion about actual facts.
When you look at the numbers that Germany is bringing in for refugees.
Right. You have a million, about a million refugees in a country of 80 million. And we have seen a very marginal increase in criminal activity that is not even necessarily linked to those people coming in. And I just want to point to the recent Department of Homeland's study that's really right. pointed to the fact that in terms of radicalization, most of that takes place years and years after people arrived in the U.S.
Generally, so, they're children, yes.
They had examples of children that were brought here early and then radicalized later. So there's really nothing you can do about some of these things. So a travel ban is really a solution to a made-up problem.
But I do think it's almost a willful ignorance about when we think about children's schools getting shot up in this country, we think about churches getting shot up. They're not immigrants that are doing this, guys. These are our American citizens.
The Orlando shooter was an American citizen.
These are American citizens who are terrorizing our country, and we don't put the same title on that. I think there's a willful ignorance almost around this conversation on some level. Not totally, but I do think on some level there's a willful unwillingness to look at the whole picture.
Absolutely.
Jim? If I could bring up just a new topic. Let's talk about Russia, all right? About Russian alleged interference in our elections. We can talk about the impact, but I think that there's some agreement there that there was attempted at interference and at influencing Donald Trump's reaction to the same. But most importantly, what's your take on this the worldwide shift that we've got going? We've got a shift in alliances that we haven't seen since the early 19th century. And at some point, I want to go to our German friend here, because Russia has always been something different over there. But what do you think of our new friend? I mean, is everybody ready to be friends with Russia? Are we going to divvy up the world? All right.
I'm not sure what we have to gain from a partnership with Russia. I'm not sure what the angle is as far as, you know, that's never seemed to come to fruition. I understand, you know, the information seems to keep dripping in as far as, well, they did interfere and there's denying on one side, but yet there's evidence on the other side that the claims from the Trump camp that, oh, no, he never met with this person. So I'm trying to see when it all congeals.
Do you think that there is danger in President Trump's apparent willingness to be friendly with Vladimir Putin?
I think, yes. I think Vladimir Putin has proven himself to be nothing but a villain.
I think Brent's got something going here.
Yeah, let's, I mean, you know, some of Trump's comments during the election run-up, you know, little too buddy-buddy there, I think, with Russia. But I think he's backed off on that. I'm not sure what they were about. But I think my biggest concern, and, you know, once again, why I'm retreated from my party and liberalism, is that, you know, and it goes back to Ben Rhodes and the echo chamber. And, you know, and I know y'all know about that, or if you don't, you know, we can talk about it again, where he bragged about manipulating the press and manipulating the rest of the public about the Iran deal. And, you know, it just seemed to be ignored. And yet I see it again and again. I see this echo chamber.
Do you think there's danger in Trump's cozying up to Putin?
I want to see him cozy up with Putin.
You do?
Haven't seen that. No. I haven't seen that. I'm not going to comment on it until I really see it. Now, now there's...
He has not expressed a concern that Putin is a danger to this country, clearly.
Well, let me put it this way. He has raised doubts about the need and effectiveness of NATO, which has always served as a counterweight to Russia. Let's put it that way.
I think that was an effective ploy. I think he laid a baseline, and now what's happening? All of these countries are saying we're going to pay up our fair share for NATO.
Okay, let's get let's get everybody else in the mix here. LaDan, you want to weigh in on this? Russia and President Trump.
Well, you called them friend earlier, but I don't know. Trump hasn't done anything in the last 46, 47 days that shows that he has befriended Putin. He's done nothing. He has not removed any of the sanction, any of the trade restriction. He hasn't done anything. He simply has not said, oh, he's my enemy. Just because he hasn't said anything, you know, that doesn't mean he's our friend. But he had made it clear that he's willing to work with everybody.
Okay, let's keep going. I want to get everybody.
I'm reminded of George W. Bush coming back from his meeting and saying that he looked into his eyes and thought that this was a person that he could trust.
This is Vladimir Putin.
Yes. And then, you know, not long after that, realizing that he had, in fact, been looking into the eyes of a murderous dictator. I'm not sure what to make of the Russian connections. Were they involved in trying to disrupt our election? I think absolutely they've been involved, as we had been in the past too. They've been involved in trying to disrupt elections all over Europe and the United States through disinformation and propaganda campaigns. Whether it goes beyond that, I don't know.
Tia, how suspicious are you that there has been a coordination, as some accuse the Trump campaign of doing, with the Trump campaign in Russia?
Well, I think that if Trump was more of an intellectual and actually seemed had an intelligence about his choices and how he's interacting and with a culture leading our country, I think I would not feel as concerned. But I definitely think that Putin is has that kind of dynamic with him. And so I'm concerned about Trump's ability to maneuver and intellectually handle where Putin could move a relationship that he seems to not be saying is not.
My thing is that obviously I don't want, you know, Trump to be a quote-unquote puppet to Putin, as a lot have like claimed and associated and think, you know, the whole collusion and thinking that Trump's just working for Putin. But I mean, Russia and the United States, the two countries in the world that have the most nuclear weapons. For me, I think that having a better relationship with the other country in the world, that, you know, our two countries could completely destroy the world. My thing is, any type of better relation with them is a positive for overall world peace. Now, does that mean that Trump needs to be a puppet or cozying up to Putin a lot? No. I mean, we saw, though, with the our ambassador to the UN demanding that Russia return Ukraine and the Crimea back to Ukraine. You know what? Excuse me, the Crimea back to Ukraine. It hasn't been. I have not seen the alleged really cozying up to Russia that a lot of people have claimed. Trump's, people have taken a lot more of, I think, a firmer stance against Russia than, you know, the claims have been made.
Johannes?
Well, I think, if anything, the developments of the last couple of weeks have made it more difficult to deal with Russia. We're seeing this switch from the Russian side now, that they are unsure what is happening. And I think that is the real danger.
They're unsure about where the Trump administration is headed.
Where the Trump administration is headed. Okay. And if they can work with them. Putting to the side the issue of election interference and all that, that is not okay. But I think with Russia, you have to deal on the issues, but you have to have open lines of communication. And I think that's a little bit the German angle on that, that if you think back to the late 90s, early 2000s, Gerhard Schröder, who was very close to the Russians, and of course historically with half of Germany being aligned with the Russians for so long, I think the sentiment has always been sanctions, as Germany is doing now along with the U.S., but open lines of communication, and I think that's key going forward.
Let me ask you one question, Johannes. You have seen talk in Europe now, just plan making, some contingency planning on What would happen if the U.S. decides not to be the glue that holds Europe together? Mm-hmm. And we've seen some talk about the French nuclear arsenal becoming kind of the muscle behind a European Union, but Germany taking a very, very big lead, mm-hmm. which is a huge
It's a huge shift.
How is that going down in that country?
I think, at least for my generation of Germans, I always very closely identified with the EU. So the big shock, Brexit, mm-hmm. and the rise of far right-wing movements that are trying to dismantle the EU, that's really the big shock for me. I have to admit, I never saw the U.S. as the glue that is holding Europe together. What I always saw as the glue that is holding Europe together is the French-German connection. So I think between those two countries and that partnership, I think a lot of younger people in Germany are certainly ready for Europe to take a bigger role and to kind of hold itself
okay.
together.
Okay. Yeah. We've got just a few minutes before the break. I want to get one quick question in here because it relates to something that's developing even as we're doing this show. President Trump on Saturday morning tweets that President Obama ordered wiretapping of Trump Tower. LaDan, do you think that President Trump, he knew something, or do you think this was an example of the president just getting Twitter happy?
So I think Obama should get Twitter happy and respond to it if he wants to.
Okay, but what do you think about President Trump?
Someone did. Someone leaked the information. I think he's maybe not him personally, but someone, one of his friends, his administration, the people left over, someone did. Why would he change the rules and the law a couple of days before he leave the office that the classified information can be shared within different agencies?
Well, what he did was to place information across various right. agencies and in the intelligence.
You're on your way out in a couple of days. Why would you do that?
All right, so you think there might be something there.
There
Who's on the other
there.
Side of this?
I have a background in public relations, and I think that the way this presidency has unfolded itself in the past 47 days is an unbelievable study in dropping ideas, planting seeds, getting it out there, whether it's real or not. It casts by saying inflammatory statements based on conjecture or delusion or actual evidence. We don't know. The fact is that the message is transferred to the public, and that on some people cast doubt, on other people, you know, they just kind of laugh at it, and other people, they have to look
Colton,
into
was
it.
That the behavior you expect from a president of the United States, throwing out an accusation without being able to offer any evidence?
Okay, so I got two parts of this. One, sure. In Trump's defense, right, which I, you know, because this is the one issue that I'm actually upset with Trump about, and I've been very, mm-hmm. I've agreed with him on a lot of different things. Obviously, I wouldn't have voted with him, you know, if I didn't. But in his defense, I mean, you know, just like Tapper said, you know, there has been no evidence that there's been actual physical, you know, workings between the Russian government, you know, Russian intelligence officials and Trump campaign working together to, you know, take the election. I mean, obviously it's an ongoing, you know, investigation. There's a lot more that could happen. I'm going to wait till I see all the facts. Okay. But back to with the Trump's thing, so with the Twitter, I don't think Twitter was the right medium to use. If you're going to make an exact, if you're going to accuse Obama of something like that, a former president, that should be a press release, or you should make that in front of Congress. But to tweet that, to me,
should you be able to present evidence to back up such a serious allegation?
You know, I think he has to have something. If not, he's going to lose a lot of points with me, you know, as a voter at least. But I mean, I don't feel like he would release an accusation like that without actually having something. But I mean, Congress needs to investigate. That's
got
the place.
Got time for just a quick comment from you, Brent, and then we'll get you, Scott, and then we got to get a break.
Well, quick question to everybody else. Where is the evidence that the Trump campaign is colluded with Russia? Where is the evidence? This is all innuendo. This is all hearsay. And this has been going on since before Trump was inaugurated.
And what about the Trump tweet that President Obama wiretapped him?
I think it's a tactic. You know, I think what it did is essentially it said, you guys have been claiming wiretap, so I'm throwing it out there now. And they backpedaled.
Scott, the very last 20 seconds.
It reminds me of the children's game, I'm rubber, you're glue. He's trying to now cast the same doubts on Obama that the Democrats have been putting on him. And it's also, I think, a diversionary tactic, because there's been so much in the press about the leaks within the White House that he's trying to pin the blame elsewhere.
All right, we got to get a break in. This is Political Rewind. We've got our citizens panel here today, and Jim Galloway sitting next to me. We're going to take a quick break and come back and conclude our conversation.
My name is Taylor Worley. I'm the reservations manager for the lodge on Little St. Simon's Island. Little St. Simon's Island is a separate island from St. Simon's Island. We only have 16 guest rooms. You can go out to a beach, look left and look right. You don't see a person, a building, or anything. You have it all to yourself for miles.
Why do you underwrite with GPB?
I think it offers the listeners a opportunity to learn more about their state, you know, as well as national subjects. It gives us the opportunity to let people know who we are and that we exist.
To find out more about becoming a corporate sponsor, email sponsorship@gpb.org.
Check out the GPB Now app. You can listen to our radio podcasts on your schedule. You can also enjoy GPB TV favorites like Georgia Outdoors, Antiques Roadshow, and Downton Abbey. And you can view exclusive digital content like Austin City Limits. To find out more about GPB Now and get download instructions, visit gpb.org/apps.
On the next Fresh Air, my guest will be Mohsen Hamid, who has written a timely novel about knowing when it's time to flee your country and what happens when you do and become an immigrant in another country that is hostile to immigrants. Hamid lives in Lahore, Pakistan, but spent part of his childhood in California, where his father was studying. He's also lived in New York and London. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. We have our citizen panel here today, and I think we need to turn, Jim, to the issue that really becomes big news this week. The Republicans have now unveiled their repeal and replace plan for Obamacare, and the president today, yesterday, weighed in and said he supports what they're doing. It's first time.
Right. He is lining up with Paul Ryan and the House Republican leadership. On his left flank, he's got Democrats. On his right flank, he's got the Freedom Caucus.
Are any of you here covered by the Affordable Care Act at
this
point?
I am. Scott.
Scott, how are you feeling about the fact that the Republicans want to dismantle it now?
For me, it would probably not make an enormous difference. If anything, despite the fact that I'm doing quite well, I think that I would qualify for a tax credit under the numbers that they've presented so far. It's still very amorphous, and I don't qualify for a subsidy, as I don't think I should at the moment. You know, in terms of what has happened as the ACA has phased in, My health insurance premiums are roughly comparable to what they were a couple of years before ACA. In the lead up right to the ACA, Blue Cross jacked up my rates enormously, and then they came back down as the ACA was phased in. My concern is that the numbers I'm seeing so far indicate that a disproportionate amount of the benefit is going to go to the higher income end of the, you know, Americans who qualify for these kind of insurance policies, and it will be taken from the lower income folks.
So most of you are on some sort of group plan, I'm assuming.
Mm. Yes.
Nevertheless, someone mentioned early on in this conversation that the Congressional Budget Office is not getting a chance to present its numbers on how many people will be covered, how much the new proposal is going to cost. The Republicans want to push this through as quickly as possible. Whether you're affected directly by the Affordable Care Act's dismantling or not, does it concern you to see leadership in Washington pushing a plan that we're not sure what the financial consequences are going to be, Brent?
Sure, but at the same time, I don't think this is the final plan. I think this is the float Number one, I don't think it's going to probably fly with a lot of right wingers. And I don't know. I really am skeptical that the Republicans are going to pull this off and Trump is going to pull this off. I hope they can. I hope they can do a better plan and reform Obamacare. I mean, I'm not against Obamacare, but I want to improve it.
Colton, you're 24, right?
Yes.
Are you on your parents' insurance?
I still am. Yes, that is correct.
Okay. All right. So what are your thoughts? I mean, under the Republican plan, as I understand it, you'd still be able to stay on until 26, but they might be able to play with your rates or your parents' rates, right?
Yes. I mean, I'm very blessed, though. We're on TRICARE. My father's military. So those things, I don't. When it comes to Obamacare, I feel like my opinion isn't as valid because of that, because I've already been on kind of more of the government kind of system, through the military and everything. But I do have to say, though, I do like the idea of the tax credit that they're giving underneath this. But it's a lot more like Obamacare light in a way. I like that they're starting. I did like some things with Obamacare. I just think the way the premiums and the single mandate, there's a lot of things that need to be worked on. But I mean, hey, it's going to go to the House, then it has to go to the Senate. There's going to be markups there. It might get sent back to the House. I mean, at least it's in the open. It's not, we need to pass it so you can read it after, like Obamacare was.
But Dan,
at least it's
over
in the open.
Years, did Republicans demonize Obamacare for partisan political reasons? And now that the reality of replacing it is upon us, is it a troubling thing to you at all?
No, I think it was wrong from the moment they started Obamacare. All the money they spent doing it, millions they spent on the website, farming it to a company in Canada, and now is a disaster. We knew this is going to happen. I was on Obamacare paying $1,400 a month, and now that I work for a company, I pay $270. But again, this is so close to the heart of every individual because it's their health and well-being. I think it's very personal. And everybody's perspective and opinion matters based on their personal experience.
Karen, you're a nurse.
Yes, I am. And I can tell you, there's not a person who would walk through the doors when I was an emergency room nurse that I didn't even know what their health insurance status was. They were getting treated. If they were dying, we were going to try to save their life. So that's my first priority, is I don't care what card you have in your wallet. The second part is that, at least a plan was put forth and rolled out. When I think about maternal fetal mortality rates in the United States being one of the worst mortality rates in the world when we're a first world country, that's a problem. And prior to the Affordable Care Act being implemented, 20% of women, pregnant women, did not have any prenatal care. And after it was rolled out, there was only 8% of women. Now, you can say that you can go to your community health center and get care, which is true, and it still costs money. There are still expectations to pay something for the care at a community health center, whereas Planned Parenthood, you can go and you can get free prenatal care.
And I think the damage with the proposed plan is already done, because I think to do away with the often demonized mandate is exactly the wrong thing. Everybody understands that if you have a car, you need to have car insurance. And it is a free market, and rates are relatively low because everybody with a car participates. So if you have an accident, the risk is spread out. Well, I would say everyone has a body. It's not a question of when you get sick, but you will have a health issue. So everybody needs to have health insurance of some shape or form.
So the mandate to you is crucial.
So a mandate is crucial unless, and I don't think that's ever going to happen in the U.S. context, you want to do a model where the risk is solely with the government, like flood insurance, crop insurance, and these things. So if you want to have a functioning marketplace, everyone who has an insurable risk needs to be on that marketplace.
Yeah, I think that it's just
this
so.
This is Tia.
This is Tia Buckham White. What really bothers me about this is that, it's going to be interesting to see the people that are of a certain socioeconomic class that voted for Trump, that actually do need their health care, when they start doing all of these things, it's not going to necessarily serve that population. And I really want to because I'm going to have insurance. I'm going to be okay. I'm going to be able to go to the doctor. But people that actually need this to work for them, it's almost like there's certain populations that have voted against their interests for different reasons. And
this
we don't really want to have that conversation
happens.
In our country. Okay. We avoid that like the plague when there's some other things that are rooted in why different populations of people make the choices they're making politically. And because we can't have that real conversation, to go back to your point, Brent, about, you know, maybe on the liberal side, we're not as open to if you say certain, they assume you're racist or they assume you're closed-minded. I think that this healthcare thing is so much more complicated, and people that are going to keep their insurance, it's the people that are going to lose it.
Okay, Jim, you had an issue. We have time for maybe one more quick round.
Okay, okay. This is a little bit lighthearted, but tell me, I need to know from each of you. Number one, do you follow Donald Trump, the real Donald Trump, and do you check in every morning to see what he says? And if so, what do you do after that?
This is Scott. I don't follow anyone on Twitter. Do I follow what he says? Yeah.
Hard to miss. Tia?
Yeah, I am on Twitter, but I do not follow the real Donald Trump.
Why not?
It's a little tiring, and I think there's a lack of depth to some of the things that are being said. I'm not talking about grammatical errors. I'm talking about conceptual ideas that
Karen?
I feel are lacking.
I follow POTUS and the real Donald Trump. It is not the first thing I look at when I wake up in the morning, but I do follow it because I think it's important to the dialogue.
Brent?
No, absolutely not.
Why absolutely?
Are you a Twitter guy at all?
Well, I'm not a Twitter guy, and I really think that, honestly, just that type of communication is frivolous, and we focus too much on that. Yeah.
LaDan?
Yes, I don't.
Of course you do.
Yes, I follow him, and I follow the other side, and every side, and everybody who says anything. And he starts at 3:30 in the morning.
Colton?
Might sound crazy because I'm a millennial, but no, I haven't used Twitter in years.
Oh, for gosh sake. All right, Johanna,
what's the latest greatest?
I don't follow him, and I think once you're elected president, you should not use your private Twitter account.
Why?
Because then you use your POTUS Twitter account because you have become the people's president.
All right. We got to stop this conversation. We are completely out of time. Thank you all so very much for being part of this conversation today and for giving us your opinions as frankly as you did. We really enjoyed having you here. Thank you, Jim Galloway.
This was fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. That's Political Rewind for today. We're back Friday at 3 o'clock. In the meantime, have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.